This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ian McEwan, is regarded by many as the best British novelist of his generation. Several of his books were adapted into films, including The Comfort of Strangers, The Cement Garden, The Good Son, and Enduring Love. His new novel, Saturday, was a bestseller in England and just hit the bestseller list in the States. It tells the story of 24 hours in the life of a neurosurgeon in London. On this day, shortly before the invasion of Iraq, a huge anti-war demonstration is filling the streets. Even upon waking, he's reminded that he's living in a post-September 11th world. He looks out the window, sees a plane in flames flash across the sky, and assumes it's an act of terrorism. Later in the day, he'll learn it's not, but here's what he's thinking as he looks out the window in the early morning, imagining what the passengers are experiencing.
Plastic fork in hand, he often wonders how it might go, the screaming in the cabin partly muffled by that deadening acoustic, the fumbling in bags for phones and last words, the airline staff in their terror clinging to remembered fragments of procedure, the leveling smell of excrement. But the scene construed from the outside, from afar like this, is also familiar. It's already almost 18 months since half the planet watched and watched again the unseen captors driven through the sky to the slaughter, at which time they gathered round the innocent silhouette of any jet plane, a novel association. Everyone agrees. Airliners look different in the sky these days, predatory or doomed. Henry knows it's a trick of vision that makes him think he can see an outline now, a deeper black shape against the dark. The howl of the burning engine continues to rise in pitch. It wouldn't surprise him to see lights coming on across the city or the squares fill with residents in dressing gowns. Behind him, Rosalind, well practiced at excluding the city's night troubles from her sleep, turns on her side. The noise is probably no more intrusive than a passing siren on the Euston Road. The fiery white core and its coloured tail have grown larger. No passenger sitting in that central section of the plane could survive. And that is the other familiar element, the horror of what he can't see. Catastrophe observed from a safe distance. Watching death on a large scale, but seeing no one die. No blood, no screams, no human figures at all. And into this emptiness, the obliging imagination set free. The fight to death in the cockpit, a posse of brave passengers assembling before a last hope charge against the fanatics. To escape the heat of that fire, which part of the plane might you run to? The pilot's end might seem less lonely somehow. Is it pathetic folly to reach into the overhead locker for your bag, or necessary optimism? Will the thickly made-up lady who politely served you your croissant and jam now be trying to stop you?
That's Ian McEwan reading from his new novel, Saturday. This book opens with what the character describes as catastrophe observed from a great distance. What interests you in that, in the sense of observing catastrophe from this distance, a distance from which you can only see the outline of what's happening and you're helpless to really do anything to stop it?
Well, I suppose in the sort of community of our anxiety, that's something we all share. I'm sure that most of the planet watched those events of 9/11. And to me, one of the most sinister aspects of it was of seeing things happen from a distance and having to set your imagination free into the into the terror that you couldn't actually witness. I mean, what was going on in those cabins in those last minutes? So it's that sense of dreamlike distance where you can only guess at the human terror. It's all sort of concealed, safely concealed from you by the very fact of distance.
I've seen several reviews that describe your novel, Saturday, as a post-September 11th book. And I'm wondering if you see the book as trying to respond to that question, you know, like, what kind of art matters after September 11th? Were you trying to respond to that, or did the subject come out of a different question?
It really came from a different direction for me. I had written a novel called Atonement, which was a historical novel, and I'd already decided, long before 9/11, that I was going to set a novel very much in the present. I wanted to get a flavour of the days we live in. I then discovered we were living in days that were sort of horribly interesting. The invasion of Afghanistan following the events of 9/11, then the long, drawn-out march, as it were, to Iraq through the UN, and a great nervousness descending on Western countries, especially in the cities. And I guess I was lucky, if you could call it that, that right near my house in central London, many of the marchers gathered to protest against the upcoming invasion of Iraq. More than 1 million people marched in central London that day. And that suddenly gave me my focus. I thought, well, this is the day. You know, this march will be the background for my man, my neurosurgeon, as he goes about his business, playing squash, visiting his dying mother, and so on.
But, you know, that march, this huge march protesting the impending invasion of Iraq, is all kind of like background noise for him. You know, he's not participating in it. He's thinking occasionally about his position on invading Iraq. He's not for war. He's an anti-war kind of person, but he thinks, you know, maybe in the long run this won't be a bad thing. So, but mostly the protest is backdrop. It's a traffic jam. It's crowds. Yeah. It's noise in the background. Why take something that momentous and put it in the background?
Well, it's very much in the foreground of Henry's thoughts. It's in the background of where he physically is. But, I mean, he has a passionate row towards the end of this novel with his daughter, you know, who's furiously against the war. Henry is ambivalent. You know, he can see that this could be a disaster. At the same time, he's treated a professor, an Iraqi professor of history, who's been tortured under the regime, and that's led him to read up a great deal about the nature of this, what one friend of mine called an abattoir state. And from the point of view of a novelist, I think a rich state of ambivalence is more productive, really. Than, you know, it's not my interest, for example, in this novel, to tell people what to think about events in Iraq. So it moves in and out of his anxieties in a very strong way indeed. I mean, it's always there. It's part, in other words, it gives a focus to all his anxieties about the state of the world we're in.
Your main character, the neurosurgeon, doesn't much like literature, though his daughter, who is a young poet, loves fiction and is kind of assigning her father books to read for him to catch up on. And he, you know, he reads his assignments but doesn't feel particularly moved by what he's reading. There's a few lines I'd like you to read on page 65.
He doesn't want to spend his days off, lying or even sitting down, nor does he really want to be a spectator of other lives, of imaginary lives, even though these past hours he's put in an unusual number of minutes gazing from the bedroom window. And it interests him less to have the world reinvented. He wants it explained. The times are strange enough. Why make things up?
Now, how did you come with these reasons to not appreciate fiction?
Well, I mean, I suppose one of the pleasures and privileges of writing a novel is you can take a tiny shred of your own impulses or thoughts and sort of irresponsibly pass them off as someone else's. And in those immediate 6 or 9 months after 9/11, I found myself reading anything but fiction. I didn't want the world invented at that point. I wanted to be informed about it. So I read books on Islam, I read books on imperialism, on the economics of the Middle East, and so on. And I don't think I was alone in this, too. I think there was a huge sort of thirst for explanations or, you know, for ways of trying to understand what had happened and what we were heading towards. And then, of course, out of that, I began to passionately want to make things up. But what I've given here to Henry is It's a sort of little game I played, because poor fellow, he's trapped in a novel by me, you know, whatever he thinks about novels, you know, he's in one. And also his day is actually going to, the logic of his day is going to bring him through a series of events that suggest, in fact, that literature has far more power than he can dream of. I suppose, too, I mean, I wrote a novel about a girl, a little girl, Bryony Tallis, in Atonement, who was so passionate about literature, couldn't really see the world in any other terms but the terms of fiction and romance. And I thought, well, I'm going to write an antidote, you know, have someone who not only loathes, you know, he doesn't loathe books, he tries hard, but he's very suspicious and thinks they're rather overrated. Actually, one of the books he dislikes most is by me. So, I mean, he doesn't like magical realism, for example, and he's very dismissive of writers like Angela Carter and Paul Auster and Gunter Grass.
Let me quote him for a second. He says, "No more magic midget drummers," he pleaded with the reporter. "Please, no more ghosts, angels, satans, or metamorphoses. When anything can happen, nothing much matters. It's all kitsch to me."
Yeah. He feels really that fiction, if it's got to have any role at all, must engage with the actual, with the plausible, and plausibly reinvent it. And again, I'm giving to him, in very extreme form, a kind of impulse of mine, which is, you know, I want to engage in this novel, although not necessarily in all novels that I write, but in this particular novel, I'm engaged with the actual, you know, this time, now, this man, you know, this city, this century.
My guest is novelist Ian McEwan, and his new novel is called Saturday. One of the funny things about your main character, the neurologist, is, you know, he's a very rational, analytical person. He doesn't like fiction. But in a way, he has the mind of a writer, because he is always thinking and always describing. And that need to always describe is something, I mean, that's just inherent to him. Don't you think in some ways he has a writer's instinct?
Well, I suppose, too, that...
that's because of you.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure there's any way around this.
Right.
But, you know, I had to describe his day, and I sort of do it over his shoulder, really, in a third person. But yes, I mean, the novel ends with a longish description of a piece of neurosurgery, which actually Henry has to perform on the very man who's intruded into his house. And... I suppose behind that I was maybe describing not only the focus and attention and concentration of writing itself, but maybe of a kind of happiness we don't really have a word for in English, or maybe perhaps not in any other language, that peculiar kind of muted joy when you're so focused on something that all time and all selfhood goes from you. You're not even conscious of being happy at the time. You're just sort of weightless, doing the thing that you're engaged in, maybe using some learned skills, maybe trying to overcome difficulties, maybe working with other people, but you are absolutely liberated into a sort of timeless sense. And you can get that with a game of tennis or doing a bit of carpentry or even gardening. I noticed that neurosurgery allows... practitioners to almost of necessity experience it by the day for hours on end. It is so demanding that your mind cannot be anywhere else. And certainly my sort of guide, Neil Kitchen, who's a senior neurosurgeon in London, said that once he got into the operating theatre, everything else dropped away. Whatever else was going on in his life, in his work, in his home, or whatever else, he was set free with no sense of passing time. And I suppose that's the state that many writers would love to get to with their writing, you know, to have one of those mornings where 3 hours can go by, you don't even look at the clock, you don't crave coffee, you don't divert yourself with phone calls or emails, and you just live in this sort of timeless joy.
The main character's mother in your new novel has dementia, and she's living in an institution for that. I know your mother had a form of dementia. Did you base this character on your experiences with your mother in the last years of her life?
Oh, very much so. I mean, she had a form of vascular dementia, which is exactly what Lily, I call her, in this novel has. And like many people in their 50s, you know, I've watched a parent empty out in that sort of horrifying way, the mind, that emptying out process is really like a sort of, it's like a death, really, and you end up finally with the body but not the personality. Very tough for everyone around. Strangely, for my mother, it wasn't Alzheimer's, which has a much bigger component of sort of mood swing and aggression. This was relatively benign for her once she had crossed the line and could no longer remember who she was and lived in a sort of constant present, a tiny window of a present, no sense of what happened a minute ago. She would speak these extraordinary sentences, and I would come away from some visits thinking, I can't make up those sentences. They are so fragmented and upended and yet so grammatically correct. So I, next time I saw her, I said, look, do you mind when we're speaking that if I write? And she said, fine, go ahead. She didn't know who I was, but at that point. And I started to write down some of her conversation, and nearly all of the things that Lily says in the novel were things said by my mother, and it felt to me like a kind of, I don't know, a kind of tribute to catching the last days of her life.
What's one of those lines that you remembered that you gave to Lily in the book?
Well, shall I read one?
Sure.
Lily suddenly speaks up. Her mood is anxious, even a little querulous. And you know that this, you know, Auntie, she calls everyone Auntie. You know, Auntie, what people put on their shoes to make them, you know, shoe polish? He never understands why she calls him Auntie, or which of her many aunts is haunting her. No, they put it all over their shoes and rub it with a cloth. Well, anyway, it's a bit like shoe polish. It's that sort of thing. We had side plates and God knows what all along the street. We had everything but the right thing because we were in the wrong place. Then she suddenly laughs. It's become clearer to her. If you turn the picture round and take the back off like I did, you get such a lot of pleasure out of it. It's all what it meant, and the laugh we had out of it. And she laughs gaily, just like she used to. And he laughs too. It's all what it meant. So there was a sort of strong emotional content to what she was saying, but she would be talking of squeezing herself through certain gaps between people and things. And you felt you almost knew what she was talking about, but never quite.
It's almost like there's a surrealistic philosophy.
Yes, it's all what it meant. Is something that, you know, she certainly did say.
How important was it to you to see her, knowing that she wouldn't know who you were anyways?
It's odd, because I, like Henry Perrone, I used to not look forward to going and try and put it off. And even then say to myself, well, look, it won't make any difference because she's not expecting me because she doesn't remember me, and she won't remember me the minute after I've gone. But I don't know. I think it's just the habits of, you know, of love and human association. You know, your mother is ill, she's in hospital or in a home. You've got to go and you've got to see her. And maybe, and this was a rather chilling thought, maybe it's not about the present anyway, it's about the past. That actually he's trying, and I was trying, still to keep alive or capture associations of when she was fully conscious, when she was fully herself.
Toward the end of your book, your main character is looking ahead, and is looking ahead to what he thinks will be a life of constant diminishment as he gets older. He's approaching his 50th birthday.
Mm.
And he's thinking ahead to, you know, him losing his physical powers and mental powers and becoming dependent on children and so on. And as you go through middle age, I'm wondering what it's like for you to think about those things yourself and at the same time try to avoid all the kind of cliches that, do you know what I mean, that people promise themselves they won't fall into?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult. You reach a certain point in life and suddenly your stash of days is looking finite. And they always were finite, but you didn't actually feel that when you were 27. And in theory, at least, that should make you approach each day with a kind of renewed determination to make the most of it. But in fact, you know, habits form and things solidify. And so, yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I think mortality tends to become a writer's subject as he or she gets to a certain age. Although I think there, you know, there are a trillion ways in which that subject can be addressed, and sometimes it comes through in a writer's work, not head on, but in a certain sort of valedictory quality, a sense of a, you know, it could be over several novels, a sense of a long goodbye.
In March of 2004, you were delayed from entering the United States from Canada. You were coming here for a series of speaking engagements. And that got a lot of attention in the newspapers. How has that affected? Well, maybe you could very briefly describe the reason why you were detained. Or not, I shouldn't say detained, but maybe I should say detained. What would be the right word?
Well, the right word. No, turn back.
Turn back. Okay.
Yeah. I was trying to come into the States. I was giving a lecture. Actually, 3,000 people were waiting for me in, the next day in Seattle. Because I was being paid for the lecture, the Homeland Security guy eventually, after many hours, turned me back, and I had to enlist the help of the State Department, plus the British consul in Vancouver, and they got me in the next day. I got a fulsome letter of apology from Homeland Security saying that, you know, they'd made a mistake. But having said that, I mean, I, you know, for this visit, I was then told I should reapply for a visa. British citizens don't usually need visas, but now my passport and the computer has the memory of me being denied entry, refused entry. And I only got in with this by the skin of my teeth, and I have to say...
This time around?
This time around, and this may be the last time I ever come to the States, because it is, I don't know, I've fallen into a bureaucratic mess. A nine-month application to a visa only just succeeded on the day I was leaving. It arrived at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it only allows me into the country for the time that I'm, you know, here to talk about this book. We had asked for a five-year visa. So it's become very difficult, and I know I feel rather perplexed. This is a country I have deep love for, and I find I'm not welcome by its... bureaucracy, and I hope we'll get this sorted out, but it's become very, very difficult indeed.
There's a scene in your novel in which your main character is at, I forget whether it's a party or it's some kind of reception, and Tony Blair is there. And Tony Blair introduces himself and starts talking about how much he likes this guy's paintings. And of course, he's not a painter, he's a neurologist, but there's no polite way of correcting Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Has this ever happened to you? While we're on the subject of identity?
Actually, well, it was at the opening of the Tate Modern Art Gallery. I was there with my wife, and we went for a little stroll with our champagnes through the newly opened work. And we were looking in the Rothkos. Then we came into another room, and there was Tony Blair and the art director of the gallery doing a photo opportunity, and there were lots of journalists and photographers standing behind a rope, braided rope, taking pictures. And the art gallery director, the gallery director sort of waved at my wife, he knew her, and brought the Prime Minister over to meet us. And the 60-odd strong retinue surrounded us, you know, flunkies and security men and journalists and diarists with their pens ready. And when the Prime Minister shook my hand, he said hello to my wife, and then he shook my hand and he said, "I really admire your work." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." He said, "Yeah, we got two of your paintings hanging in Downing Street." And I said, "No, no, no." And he said, "Yes, yes." And he went on shaking my hand. And then someone said, "Prime Minister, we've got 2 minutes to be at the front door." And the whole lot of them just swept on, leaving us standing there sort of like rabbits in the headlights. And then the diarists clustered round at me and said, what did he say? What did he say? And I thought quickly, and I said, the Prime Minister said he really liked my work. And I left it at that because I thought, no, I'm having this story. I'm not giving it to you guys. So I, you know, 2 or 3 years later, used it in this novel.
Well, Ian McEwan, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Ian McEwan's new novel is called Saturday.